So I suppose chronologically in the history of life on Earth, Jeff's talk would have come first, you know, sort of what was available in the soup, and then my talk would come second, the beginning of genetics, and then Jack's talk would have come third, cellular compartmentation and so on. Although some might suggest that you have to cellular compartments before you could even start genetics. Maybe we can discuss that. So what I want to do today is first some introductory remarks just to kind of remind you what this notion of an RNA world is all about and how to think about the problem. Then just a bit about the... Oh, that seems overmodulated. Then just a bit about the actual origins of life problem with regard to the RNA world. But mostly what I'm going to talk about, and the title of my talk is Building the RNA World. This is going to be a talk about experimental results. So mostly I'm just going to show you a lot of data of things we do in the lab to push towards making an RNA world on the bench. Okay? So let me start with biology as we know it. So this is the biology we all know and love, the only biology we know, both extant and based on the fossil record. All biology that we know of has DNA as a genetic material, RNA as the informational intermediary, and protein is the chief agent of catalytic function, of metabolic function. But as I'm sure most of you know, and if you heard Jack's talk, and maybe Jeff covered this as well, it's widely believed that this is not the kind of system that was the first living system on this planet because of the so-called chicken and egg problem, that in order to replicate the genetic information, you need the catalytic function of proteins to carry out that replication process. And yet, in order to produce proteins, you need the genetic information that exists within DNA. So this is the egg, and this is the chicken, and that's the chicken and egg problem. It's long been suggested, long before the discovery of catalytic RNA, long before the realization of the role, the pervasive role of RNA in modern biology, it's long been suggested that there may have been a different form of life on this planet other than the one with which we're familiar, a form of life in which RNA was both the genetic instruction and the agent of metabolic function. So this goes back to the late 60s. Carl Woese, Francis Crick, Leslie Orgel, published papers in that time, talking about this notion that what was now recognized to be the central dogma of biology, the DNA, RNA, protein-based system that we recognize in biology, is unlikely to have been the first form of life. And Crick in particular talked about a different form of life based on RNA and pointed very sharply to what is the key feature of RNA-based life, and that is bringing chicken and egg together in the same molecule. All right, so that means a molecule that is both a genetic instruction and the agent of egg laying, namely copying the genetic instructions, or so-called replication or replicase function. So Crick said this in 1968, possibly the first enzyme, and those are his quotes, or a quotation around enzyme, possibly the first enzyme wasn't a protein, was an RNA molecule, and the most important function for an RNA molecule in RNA-based life, the sort of central function for RNA, would have been to replicate RNA genomes, so-called RNA replicase properties. Now, other things likely would have been necessary, like producing the building blocks for replication, building some sort of metabolism, maybe creating a compartment and so on, but the central function is to produce more eggs from an existing egg by virtue of a chicken, that chicken being the RNA replicase molecule. Now, that leads us to the so-called notion of RNA-based life, and I'm not going to talk too much about why I put circa 3.9 billion years ago, but that's sort of constrained on both ends by different boundary conditions. But the notion is life based entirely on RNA, or at least the informational macromolecules that are part of life, only being RNA, RNA genomes, an RNA-based catalytic function, metabolic function. Now, the phrase, the RNA world, wasn't actually coined until after the discovery of metabolic RNAs. So it wasn't until the 80s, the early 80s, that Tom Cech and Sid Altman discovered that RNA can actually be an enzyme, that RNA enzymes exist in biology. And then I would say that was kind of a gold rush for RNA. Maybe that was the first gold rush, and now we're seeing a second one with all the focus on microRNAs and siRNAs and riboswitch RNAs and so on. But in the early 80s, it was then proven that RNA can be an enzyme, and furthermore, that RNA enzymes exist in biology. And a lot of people then swarmed under this notion that first was brought up in the late 60s, and it was Wally Gilbert in 1986 in a little one-page News and Views in Nature that coined the phrase that has stuck. Wally has coined a number of phrases that have stuck. I mean, he came up with introns and exons, for example. He said, quote, one can contemplate an RNA world, his quotes. And the title of this little one-page News and Views was The RNA World. And this was the payoff sentence here. One can contemplate an RNA world containing only RNA molecules that serve to catalyze the synthesis of themselves. Now, this is a radical overstatement here because we, of course, don't imagine that the only components of the RNA world were RNA molecules. What he's getting at is that the only informational macromolecules, those for which there's a basis in Darwinian evolution and heritability, are RNA molecules. And, of course, their only function need not have been to catalyze the synthesis of themselves. That was a key function, as Crick pointed out, and one presumes there were other functions that, as well. But the same idea, that is the central function of an RNA-based genetic system, is to bring about the copying of the RNA genetic material. And then synthesis of themselves, well, I don't think one literally imagines that the enzyme contorts itself to copy itself. I think one imagines that the RNA enzyme or RNA replicase copies other copies of RNA. And of course, there's also the plus and minus strand problem. So the RNA replicase copies plus to minus and minus to plus. So with all those caveats, this is still the sentence that that hit pay dirt and coined the phrase that has stuck in the field. So literally, what are we talking about? We're talking about strings of RNA molecules of a particular sequence that then are amplified or reproduced to produce progeny strings of RNA molecules of a very similar sequence built of the building blocks of RNA, the four different letters of RNA. And those strings also have the ability to not just be information, but to fold in particular secondary and tertiary structures, and by virtue of that folded shape, carry out catalytic function. Specifically, as Crick pointed out, as Gilbert pointed out, the catalytic function of promoting, of catalyzing, the replication process of taking parental strings of RNA and producing progeny strings. Now, inevitably, there's going to be errors. There's going to be mutations arising spontaneously in this process. And so that, of course, then becomes the grist for evolution. The strings, copied strings, resemble the parents but are not perfectly identical. There's the possibility of occasional mutation. Those mutations may be neutral, they may be detrimental, but they may be beneficial. And if they're beneficial, for example, in leading to better enzymatic function to promote better copying or higher fidelity copying or interesting accessory functions, whatever is selectively advantageous, then those variants stick, and those variants enjoy differential survival. So that's putting a finer point on the notion that Crick raised in the 60s and that Gilbert raised in the 80s. But did the RNA world really exist? So I said that at the outset, all the life that we know about on Earth, all the life for which there's evidence in the fossil record, is DNA and protein-based life. Sure, there are RNA genomes and RNA viruses, but those RNA viruses are parasites of DNA and protein-based life. There's no standalone evolving RNA-based genetic systems, RNA-based organisms known on Earth or in the fossil record. So is this all just sort of a fantasy that that we're sort of in a collective delusion state inspired by the fact that RNA can be an enzyme? We see that in biology. But of course, those enzymes are encoded in the DNA. Those RNA enzymes can be a genome, as I mentioned, in viruses, in RNA viruses and retroviruses. But what's to say that an RNA world really occurred historically on this planet? And I don't mind saying this for the record since this is being recorded. We do not have direct evidence to come to that conclusion. Okay. Now, this does not then launch 1,000 creationist ships in search of some wild non-scientific explanation. It then forces us to think about, well, what, if not direct evidence, what circumstantial evidence might there be that an RNA world preceded a DNA and protein-based world? And it's possible that there was an RNA-based life form on this planet, and then it gave rise to or was taken over by a DNA and protein-based life form, and there's no evidence whatsoever to be found of that RNA-based life form. I mean, that's possible, and I think it's made more possible because RNA is a very fragile molecule. RNA at constant, I mean, let's say, room temperature and typical concentrations of divalent cations has a half-life per bond, or has a rate of decomposition per bond within the RNA polymer of about 10 to the minus 5th, 10 to the minus 6th per minute. So, you know, strings of thousands of nucleotides of RNA just aren't going to last over the eons, not even over a few hundred years. You know, there's a reason when one goes scraping a little blood sample for forensic information, one does not go after the RNA, even though there's many more copies of the RNA than the DNA. One goes after the DNA because it's much more stable. So it's possible there's no evidence whatsoever that there was an RNA world. But in fact, there is some what I would call circumstantial evidence. I don't want to go through all that today. Maybe we can discuss some of it. Doran, yes? It's, well, actually, it's four atoms, right? Because it's CH3 instead of hydrogen at the 5 position of uracil, as well as oxygen instead of... Absolutely.
So, I'm trying to go the other way.
Okay.
I'm not something very strong RNA, but I would like to point out that in a prebiotic situation where you could get all sorts of sugar,
yes,
all sorts of bases,
yes,
all sorts of phosphate-like backbone,
right,
elements, just sticking to the idea that RNA is unstable and DNA is stable.
Well, okay.
There must have been some form, perhaps an intermediary or some other kind. It was stable enough. It was still coding.
Yes. I agree completely. So this is now the notion of the pre-RNA world, that there was something other than RNA before RNA, right? And then maybe later RNA, and I'm just about to get to why we think there really was an RNA world, and then later still DNA and protein. But that something before RNA, call it pre-RNA, maybe it was something more stable.
Don't think for pre-RNA, but there is a principle of RNA. The principle of RNA in many, many different...
Yeah, no, pre is PRI for principle. I understand completely. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about the sugar issue. You're saying, well, if in a prebiotic soup, if there's ribose, the sugar of RNA, which makes this kind of fragile polymer. And by the way, fragile over the geologic record, but not too fragile for sort of day-to-day messing around, I would say. DNA is about 6 logs more stable than RNA to hydrolytic cleavage. Now, DNA is more susceptible to deprionation than RNA, but the thing that one, I think, worries about is the backbone breaking down spontaneously. It's 10 to the minus 13th per minute for DNA. It's sort of 25 degrees, few millimolar divalent for DNA, 10 to the minus 6-ish for RNA. So it's, 6 or 7 logs more stable. The problem is, in the prebiotic soup, as one imagines how there might be sugars in the prebiotic soup, it's difficult to see how those sugars would include deoxyribose. Ribose, yes. Other pentoses, I'll talk about that shortly. But deoxyribose isn't on the list for chemical reasons I don't want to get into. It doesn't assemble itself from aldehydes, is the bottom line, whereas ribose and many other sugars do. So let me just come back to this question. And what evidence do we have, albeit circumstantial? So I go back to Crick in 1968. And a few paragraphs down from when he pointed to the notion that maybe the first enzyme was an RNA molecule with replicase activity for replicating RNA, he wondered whether the ribosome, at least a primitive version of the ribosome, and this is his italics, could have been made entirely of RNA. Now, why did he say that? Well, if RNA came before DNA and protein, then RNA, in an evolutionary sense, had to invent protein synthesis and invent a reverse transcription process to carry RNA-based information into DNA. If RNA invented the translation process out of RNA, then the original, the Ur translation machinery, would have been made out of RNA, right? It would have been made entirely out of RNA. I'd say by definition, it can't be made out of proteins until protein synthesis, encoded protein synthesis, is invented. So Crick suggested this, and it's possible, one could imagine, that there was an RNA world. RNA invented, in an evolutionary sense, protein synthesis, that the original ribosome, the Ur ribosome, was made entirely of RNA, but all record of that has been erased, and now the ribosome is really a protein machine using modern, I say modern, you know, in the last 3.9 billion years, modern macromolecular machinery, namely proteins. But I think we know, I hope you all know, that the ribosome, even today, the modern ribosome, is still an RNA machine. So this is from the Stites and Moore lab, but of course, Harry Noller's group at Santa Cruz, Ada Jones' group, and others have been now have several looks at the ribosome. And this is the atomic resolution crystal structure of the ribosome. Shown in gray is the protein. Shown in gray is the RNA part, the ribo in ribosome, and shown in gold are the proteins. Now, the active site, the place where proteins are synthesized, where peptide bond formation occurs, is right here. Those are the amino acyl and peptidyl tRNAs sitting right in there in the active site. And there's not a single amino acid of protein within 20 or some odd angstroms, 22 angstroms of that active site. Literally, the proteins are draped about the outside for the most part. There's a couple penetrating helices. But the proteins are far away from the business part of the ribosome. So even today, the ribosome is a ribozyme. It's recognized both structurally and mechanistically as an RNA enzyme that brings about protein synthesis. So Crick was right, I think. Now, this isn't proof of the RNA world, but it is consistent with the notion if RNA was there before and then RNA invented protein synthesis, the first ribosome would have been made out of RNA. And amazingly, even the ribosomes in your body continue to be RNA machines. Now, there's other evidence that I could discuss that is in the category of sorry. Yes. Yes.
If you omit the protein,
correct.
Then the ribosome.
If yes. So Harry Noller has done some very nice work where he stripped the proteins away. And he has not been able to 100% remove all the proteins. He's been able to get to about 98% removal. There's a particular buried helix of a protein that is difficult to remove without compromising the structure of the ribosome. The general feeling in the field now is that the proteins help the ribosomal RNA fold and assume a well-defined shape. They're not involved in the actual mechanism of translation. After all, the message is RNA, messenger RNA. The adapter machinery are tRNAs, and the catalytic machinery is ribosomal RNA. The proteins are a kind of chaperone for RNA to help it fold into its functional shape. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely possible. You know, so here we don't have a lot of historical things to point to, but you know, maybe not long, complex, genetically encoded polypeptides, but amino acid cofactors, maybe dipeptides, maybe short peptides that were of a statistical nature rather than a well-defined sequence, maybe alternating hydrophil, hydrophobe amino acids to create kind of a sheet structure. Help fold the RNA or act as a co-catalyst. So, you know, although it's not the case here, one can imagine that RNA enzymes rely on amino acids and small peptides as actual cofactors for catalysis. That's possible. And I would say don't just limit it to peptides, though. Metal ions, especially divalent metals. Other small molecules that might be available in the environment. This is very reasonable concept. Okay, so as I say, I'm not going to go through a lot of the other evidence having to do with what is RNA doing these days that has an ancient look and feel to it. But this is the one I think that's the strongest. This is the so-called smoking gun, you know, of the RNA world, or at least as close as you're going to get. Barring the possibility, I don't think it's impossible, that someday in some very isolated environment, I don't know, deep under Lake Vostok or something, one finds an RNA-based organism that hasn't been subsumed by the, I would say, more aggressive from the point of view of RNA, more aggressive DNA and protein-based world. So it's not impossible to me that it doesn't exist somewhere on this planet, but it certainly hasn't been found, and it's going to take a very special environment for that molecule to still exist. Next question, and this is really the meat of what the talk is about, and I really hesitate, especially since it's being videotaped, to use the word created. Okay, I mean synthesized, okay? I mean biochemists, chemists, molecular biologists, all the tools of the modern laboratory, well-educated graduate students and postdocs, hopefully wise and not too distracted principal investigators. Can they synthesize the RNA world in the laboratory? Okay. And this notion that one can carry out a proof of principle, a demonstration proof of things that cannot be seen in the physical geological record, actually has a long history. The classic experiment being that of Stanley Miller, himself being a very impressive graduate student. This is a period picture. This is him at the University of Chicago in 53. You know, are there graduate students in the audience? Or it looks more advanced than that. See, grad students then had to wear ties. You know, so faculty did too. So, of course, the classic experiment of trying to simulate the prebiotic environment leading to the phrase and the material, the so-called prebiotic soup. Now, of course, the Miller-Urey experiment, as it's come to be known, didn't generate, at least not in detectable quantities at that time, didn't generate any of the building blocks of RNA, but did generate many of the amino acids. And that was sort of an earth-shaking experiment. Of course, in retrospect, it got way overplayed. I mean, Vogue magazine did a story on Stanley Miller and how he was making life in the lab, you know. What he'd done was shown, it's a lot like Wohler's experiment, you know, going back to the 1800s, of synthesizing urea from abiotic materials, and birthing organic chemistry. So this was synthesizing biological materials from abiological organic materials and birthing prebiotic chemistry.
Well, 130 years later,
why is it ground-shaking? Because I think it gave... let's not talk about the public perception. Let's talk about in science, why is it ground-shaking? I think it gave confidence to scientists that experimentally this could be reduced to practice. All right. Now, it's been a long road. Wohler did, yes. But not, I think, in Wohler's case with the goal of synthesizing life. There with the goal of synthesizing a molecule of life. So, I mean, they all stand on each other, right? So Wohler, I think, was the fact that chemistry could be a discipline, I think, is the beginning of the step, to realize we don't just take what's given, we can make what we want. Wohler said, well, we can make things that are in the province of biology. Stanley Miller's experiment, I think, led people to think that, well, we could make biology itself. But see, you're looking at this from 2006. We know what's in his soup, all right? But I'm saying this was, I think, an intellectual breakthrough. I mean, you may disagree. Okay. In any case, that's the paradigm. So let's just do that. But now let's do that for the RNA world, right? Let's come up with a prebiotic soup of sorts in which we can cook up an RNA world. Well, this is a hard game, and now I'm going to get into what are to me the key obstacles in understanding the sort of birth of the RNA world out of the soup. So we have to make ribose, the sugar ribose, all right? And to be more specific, this has to be the beta anomer. That means this hydroxyl has to be up, not down. It has to be the D stereoisomer. It has to be the pentose sugar ribose as opposed to other pentose sugars. And it has to be in the furanose, the five-membered ring conformation, rather than the pyranose, the six-membered ring conformation, even though ribose prefers to be in the pyranose. So this is, when we say ribose, the sugar component of the RNA molecule and therefore of the RNA world, we actually mean, to a chemist, beta-D ribofuranose. But in any kind of prebiotic soup that would contain a mixture of aldehydes that would assemble to make ribose, and that's a very doable synthesis, a little glycoaldehyde, a little glyceraldehyde, and you make ribose. You can't help but make, at the same time, the alpha anomer and equal amounts of the DNL stereoisomer and the other pentoses, like xylose and arabinose, as well as tetroses and hexoses and branch sugars, and as I said, not just the furanose, but the pyranose form of ribose. So this gets into what I call prebiotic clutter. This, to me, is the fundamental problem understanding how the RNA world might have come out of the soup, and what leads me and others to think that maybe there was a pre-RNA world or a pre-RNA world before the RNA world that didn't face the kind of clutter problems that RNA faced. Now, that's the clutter about the sugar. The sugars have to be joined together by phosphates in the so-called sugar phosphate backbone. And specifically in RNA, that linkage is from the 3' position, the 3' hydroxyl of one sugar, to the 5' hydroxyl of another via a phosphate linkage, so-called 3-5 phosphate linkage. But in a prebiotic sense, without divine intervention or experimental intervention or evolved intervention from evolved enzymes, in addition to making 3-5 phosphate linkages, one couldn't help but have other types of connectivities and other type of linkages, not just one phosphate, but two or more, and substituted phosphates. And so there's clutter about the linkages and the nature of the linker. Now come the bases, the purines. Well, adenine and guanine are the purines of choice in RNA, and it's fairly straightforward to make adenine, quote-unquote, prebiotically. The Aroh synthesis of adenine is simply take hydrogen cyanide, exposed to UV light, and adenine is produced in reasonable yield, as well as guanine, but as well as all kinds of other purines and substituted purines. So there's clutter about the purines. And similarly, the pyrimidines, which are actually more difficult to synthesize in a prebiotic sense, but it has been achieved, are cluttered about by other pyrimidines and substituted pyrimidine compounds. So this is not a challenge in the laboratory, because in the laboratory, one can do away with the clutter just by choosing what molecules to focus on. You know, if we want ribose, we'll only order ribose from sigma. If we want 3,5 linkages, we will only synthesize them in the 3,5 way. We'll exclude any bases except A, U, G, and C. We can play that game in the laboratory, and biology, of course, can play that game because biology enjoys the specificity of evolved enzymes that only produce what you want. But now we have to think about prebiotically. There's no chemists, there's no sigma catalog, there's no reagent grade materials, there are no enzymes to resolve these things. So what's the way out of that? Well, this is a whole other lecture which I'm not going to get into, but one has to then think about prebiotic fractionation processes. We and others have looked what makes ribose special. You know, is there a way that one can start with a mixture of all the different sugars and pluck out only ribose? And actually we have a mode for that. If we take the whole mixture of sugars that I showed you previously and add the compound cyanamide, all the sugars react with cyanamide and form a sugar cyanamide product. But the ribocyanamide product forms a bicyclic compound that then crystallizes as a very clean crystal, comes out of solution and leaves all the other sugar cyanamides behind. And once brought down in the crystal, is very stable. If you take mixtures of DNL version of all the sugars, only ribose in the present cyanamide comes down as the DL ribose cyanamide product with DNL enantiomorphous zones within the crystal, leaves all the other sugars behind. In principle, then you could wash away the supernatant, you would have just pure crystals of ribocyanamide. We can then take those crystals, react them with cyanoacetylene, and form pyrimidine nucleosides. All right, so we can play these kind of tricks of selective chemistry, not biochemistry. This is not an enzymatic trick. This is taking advantage of differential chemical properties of ribose compared to the other sugars, and we can start to break away the clutter. But frankly, it becomes kind of a just-so story because you've got to break away the clutter for ribose. You've got to concoct why cyanamide comes in now, then the crystals are kept, the supernatant's washed, then it's cyanoacetylene, but not until at that point, and then how you deal with the similar clutter that exists about the linkages and the bases. You need another kind of story. You know, people in the field, including ourselves, work on those stories, and I don't discount the possibility that someday we will have a sort of privileged path through the clutter to the RNA molecule, to the complete RNA molecule. But it's not there right now, and there is an alternative, and the alternative is, well, maybe RNA wasn't the first form of life, just as we think DNA and protein wasn't the first form of life. Maybe there were a succession of life forms on this planet, and the next to last was RNA, and we can still see its remnants in the last, the DNA and protein-based life, and then finally the DNA protein-based life, and now we seem to be locked in, at least for the last 3.9 billion years, although who knows. So that's just a kind of a summary of what the thinking is in the field. But look, I've cleared the clutter. I just hit the button, cleared the clutter, avoided all the molecules I don't want because... Can I do it again? Why? I don't know. There's a lot of clutter about this thing. I think what's more dramatic is the mess in itself. How many things swarm about RNA? So, you know, I'd say the sugar problem is looking better now than it did a few years ago. The linkage problem is really severe. And actually, the 2,5 linkage is favored over the 3,5. So now you can say, well, maybe the pre-RNA world or the pre-RNA world was a 2,5 RNA, right? And then later came a 3,5 RNA. But 2,5 RNA has all kinds of other problems. It's even less stable than 3,5 RNA. It forms better, but it also breaks easier. So I'm not sure that helps us. It does Watson-Crick. It'll even cross-pair with 3,5 RNA. So that's an advantage. And you could say, well, you know, who said it had to be A and G? Maybe it's kind of a mixture of A-like and G-like things. But, you know, then you need some way, though, to resolve the things that don't play nicely. And some of these really confuse... you know, like xanthine, for example, can pair two different ways, and so you have ambiguity of information. You know, maybe there's answers for all of this, but okay, and Doran, here you go. But we do, because we are in charge of how we spend our money in the lab, which means we are in charge of what molecules we allow into our test tube. We only allow RNA through the clutter. Okay, there you go. I don't use PowerPoint. You can't do that kind of junk in PowerPoint. You have to use Keynote, but brought to you by Apple. Okay. To live in the clutter. Yeah. So there are severe problems living in the clutter. And I alluded to a couple of them already. You know, preserving information would be very difficult because there's going to be ambiguous pairing in the clutter. And then one of the most severe ones, and this goes back to work I did many years ago with Leslie Orgel, one of the hardest things to resolve in the clutter is the DNL problem, all right, the enantiomer problem, because until the mirror was broken in some way, either by some mechanism the physicists are going to give us, an amplification thereof, or some mechanism the chemists are going to give us for resolving a racemate, or some mechanism biology is going to give us, you know, that biological history went to one isomer or the other. In a prebiotic soup, there's roughly equal amounts of DNL. And a severe problem for RNA is that the L is a chain terminator for polymerization of the D and vice versa. Okay? And so that's a real killer. So you cannot live in the clutter. You know, so just like your hands, you know, so the bases are flat. All right? The sugars then, sugar phosphate makes the backbone. So now let's imagine, you know, so this is the base for pairing, and this is the backbone coming away. And they're mirror images, DNL, all right? And so I can imagine a D or an L pairing, all right? Now, you know, things are, my thumb's on the wrong side. Well, I do it like this, all right? So now imagine these are the hydrogen bonding interactions, 1, 2, 3, or 2 if it's an AU pair, all right? So that's the hydrogen bonding interaction. And I've now got that same hydrogen bonding interaction because the bases are flat. Right, so D and L, there's no doubt I have two different handedness, but I rotate the base over, and because it's flat, I can still engage in the same pairing. And that's why this will be the D, because it's my right hand. This is a D will come and slip in what, in principle, is a string of L's. But notice the angle at which my wrist leaves, which is the next position down the backbone, is off compared to where it would leave on an L. And that's why it's a chain terminator. It's a beautiful, it adds beautifully to a growing chain for this reason, but it terminates the chain for that reason. And that's a killer problem. No one has seen a way around that. And so some people have said that the pre-RNA world was an achiral molecule, was a compound unlike ribose of RNA that doesn't have a handedness, that got things rolling, started developing enzymatic catalytic wherewithal, and the problem of breaking the mirror was deferred until Darwinian evolution had already started. So, anyway, it's very difficult to live with the clutter, unless, of course, you can just buy your way out of the clutter. And now we come to really what is the main part of my talk, which is we're not going to solve the clutter problem in the talk today or what we do day to day in the lab. We think about it. We work on it. We just want to make an RNA world. And so this isn't really Stanley Miller-like, because Stanley Miller was trying to simulate what at that time was thought to be the prebiotic environment. Now, the field has gone back and forth, and actually in the latest incarnation, his view of the prebiotic environment is starting to look pretty good again, but he and Urey had a particular view of the prebiotic environment. We're not getting into that game. Our view is, let's use sterile Eppendorf tubes. Let's use good laboratory practice. Let's use ultra-pure water that has no ribonuclease in it. Let's use only the desired compounds, add them in the order in which we want. We just want the proof of principle. We want an RNA-based evolving system operating on our benchtop. And in other words, we want one of these. We want an RNA molecule, and I'm sure Jack Szostak talked about this, we want an RNA molecule that is the molecule that Francis Crick and Wally Gilbert have talked about, an RNA molecule that catalyzes the copying of other RNA molecules with reasonable fidelity, including molecules that are copies, genetic copies of itself or of the opposite strand. So that's what we want to build. Now, how to build one of these things? Well, remember, the game is not out of the soup anymore. The game is, what can the scientists do? And so in thinking about the history of life on Earth, we didn't have Darwinian evolution before we had Darwinian evolution. But in the laboratory, we can use Darwinian evolution as a process to bring about the development of molecules that we're interested in. And so this is so-called directed evolution or in vitro evolution of RNA, where evolution is a technology that is applied to RNA molecules to evolve RNA molecules that have the biochemical properties we're interested in, namely of those of a polymerase or replicase type molecule and other interesting functions of RNA. So in vitro evolution of RNA requires the same general principles as Darwinian evolution in nature. There has to be a way to amplify, a way to mutate, and a way to select. The way we amplify RNA molecules is just technology, and I want to stay away from the technology in this talk, but suffice to say, it is very standard for a molecular biologist to begin with RNA and then produce more of it by copying that RNA to a complementary DNA and then to double-stranded DNA, maybe running the PCR to make lots and lots of copies of that double-stranded DNA and then producing RNA back from that. Or one can take RNA, make complementary DNA, double-stranded DNA, and then just directly produce RNA from that. So if you give me a femtomole of RNA in the morning, by noontime I can give you back an animal. Okay, maybe a micromole, depending on how much money I want to spend on enzymes for this process. So amplification of RNA with high fidelity can be achieved. Selection is then something we impose on a population of RNA molecules that becomes a challenge that the RNA molecules must surmount in order to be eligible for amplification. So we're going to demand that the RNA molecules perform a function. If and only if they perform that function, will they then be amplified? And then finally, we need a mutation process. We need a way to introduce variation in the population. And typically, we do that with a procedure we developed many years ago for so-called mutagenic PCR, to introduce random mutations while we're carrying out the PCR amplification. So, as I say, it's just technology. I think the part everyone cares about the most, though, is how do you do this selection, especially in the direction of leading a population of RNA molecules toward the ultimate goal of becoming the replicase molecule that Crick and Gilbert talked about. All right, so what we want is we want an RNA enzyme that brings about RNA joining directed by an RNA template. We want to have a template of RNA, we want to have a growing chain of RNA, and we want to have an incoming piece of RNA, all of which, so the growing chain and the incoming piece bind on the template, and the end of the chain then attacks the incoming piece to make that next joining. That's what we're after. All right, and so this is going to be standard RNA. This is going to be standard RNA. Now, what to do here? What to place at the end of the growing piece as the electrophile, as the reactive group? There's a lot of choices, some more reactive than others. I think Jack Szostak talked about putting imidazole phosphate at the end of RNA monomers, which is highly reactive, and even without an enzyme, polymerizes very nicely. I'd say maybe a little too nicely, a little out of control, but you know, but the chemistry is there. We like the triphosphate, which is also nature's choice, because it's kinetically, I wouldn't say inert, but it's kinetically very stable compound. It's highly resistant to hydrolysis or to attack by nucleophiles, including this hydroxyl. However, the delta G for performing that reaction at kind of typical laboratory conditions is about negative 10 kcals per mole. So it's a high-energy bond, but it's kinetically almost inert. It really takes a catalyst to spring that energy and bring about that joining reaction. And that's a great place for a catalyst, is where there's something that's difficult to do spontaneously, but there's a lot there to get if only you had a catalyst to perform it. So now we need to select RNA molecules that will do this. And the paradigm looks something like this. Let's connect the incoming piece to the template, and then connect the template to just a whole bunch of random nucleotides, because a priori we don't know where this enzyme is going to come from. It's going to come out of RNA sequence. So let's just start with a very large population of RNA sequences. All right? And some small, very small subset of those randomly chosen sequences will bring about this reaction. And if they do, they will be the selected ones. They will be amplified, mutated to produce progeny. Their progeny will be challenged, and so on. And the idea is to evolve one's way up to starting with random nucleotides, ultimately to an enzyme, an RNA enzyme, that very nicely brings about this joining reaction. Now, the technology here has to do with selective amplification. The selection is that particular reaction, but the amplification has to do with PCR. So PCR, if you know anything about it, has to do with two primer binding sites, reciprocal primer binding sites, reciprocal primer extension reactions to copy the copy of a copy. And what we do is we put one primer binding site at the end of the population of RNA molecules, the other primer binding site at the beginning of the growing chain. If and only if this joining reaction occurs, do the two primer binding sites become unified? If and only if the joining reactions occur, can reverse transcription PCR amplification lead to millions to billions of copies? So that's the trick. And actually, Jack Szostak, I don't know if he talked about it, but the first example of developing an RNA enzyme to carry out this particular reaction was done in his lab in the early 90s and led to this molecule, the so-called class 1 RNA ligase. So Dave Bartel, a former graduate student with Jack's and Jack Szostak in 93, published a paper where they started with 220 random sequence RNAs, carried out, 10 rounds of this test tube evolution process, like I just described, introduced occasional random mutations using our old mutagenic PCR procedure, and ended up with this, no longer random sequence, I'm not showing the actual sequence here, but there's a particular sequence involved of 118 nucleotides, forms this set of stems and loops, and brings about the template-directed joining reaction between an RNA primer, if you will, or substrate, and the triphosphate at the 5' end of the RNA itself, and does quite a nice job. So the catalytic rate of about 14 per minute, which is about a 10 to the 8th fold rate acceleration over the uncatalyzed reaction, and with a nice little KM as well. So an RNA joining enzyme born out of random sequence thanks to test tube Darwinian evolution. But, you know, that's just one joining. A polymerase, a replicase, has to do many joinings. So then what Dave Bartel subsequently did, Dave then left Jack's lab, became independent at the Whitehead Institute at MIT, and he started with this RNA joining molecule, so-called class 1 RNA ligase, and demanded more, demanded that in a somewhat different format, it would take an external template and a primer and add, not do just a simple joining reaction, but add NTPs, nucleoside triphosphates, to the end of the primer and add more than one of them. And there's a lot of little tricks here. There's this funny little 5-5 linkage to present this primer piece at the end of the ribozyme. There are sites of randomization shown in blue. There's an entirely new 78 random nucleotide accessory domain that was added from which this enhanced function would arise. And the selection scheme is different now. The selection scheme is there's a tag. There's a thiouracil tag is what he used, but one can imagine other chemical tags. There's a tag on the last of the NTPs to be added. So if and only if the ribozyme adds the NTPs up to and including the tagged NTP, does itself become tagged and therefore selectable and therefore selectively amplifiable. Yes, well, let's see. It took them more than 6 days. Ooh, I've got to watch out, I'm recorded. but less than, how long did it totally take them to do this? I think real-time work on doing the evolution work, probably less than 6 months. You know, a lot of analytical time, a lot of setup time, and so on, and some pursuing of false leads. Yeah. Now, but I'm glad you raised this, because as I progress through the talk and bring you up, because, you know, we're still back in the early 90s here. As I bring you up to date, keep that in mind. How much evolution can one do? Right? Because if suppose it's a long road to a replicase. Suppose we have to do not just 10 rounds of evolution, which they did in 6 months. Suppose it's going to take hundreds of rounds of it. Or suppose it doesn't take that, but wouldn't it be fun just to do hundreds of rounds of evolution to see what evolution looks like very longitudinally? So wonder about that, and then I'll come to you. Yep. And then wonder about the sociological question. How do you persuade a graduate student, right, to keep manipulating clear, small volumes of clear color solutions in the hope that sequence space will be kind to them, right? So there's a motivational challenge as well as just the tedium, and I would say the technical issue too, that, you know, the more work you do of evolution, you know, the more chance there is to make a mistake, you know, a technical mistake. So all this will be an issue, and I'm going to, as the talk proceeds, you're going to see the pace of evolution just really rev up on you. Okay, yep. A very large number. And this is the class 1 ligase. There's also a class 2 ligase, which makes a 2-5 bond instead of a 3-5 bond and does so much slower. There's a class 3 ligase, which is even slower. And then they didn't bother to, but we and others that do this test tube evolution game, you know, as many clones as you're willing to isolate and characterize, you can keep digging deeper and deeper into the suboptimal solutions. And some studies have looked at that, you know, and begin to look at the fitness landscape. Again, though, then you get into sociology, how to persuade a student or postdoc to spend their thesis or their postdoc years looking at all the dogs rather than, you know, the best in show. So there is a tendency in the field to cherry pick the best. All right, and I think, and I'll come to you, and there's a very serious problem with cherry picking, that often in cherry picking, diversity is thrown away. Okay, so as those that think about evolution know, the diversity of the population is important, because those suboptimal solutions at present, given a slight change in selection constraints, in fitness, in definition of fitness, or even neutral drift, they might, those suboptimal solutions at present might find their way to become the optimal or the local optimal solution in the future. So there has been, I'd say, and I've written about this and preached about this, there's been an unfortunate, what I call, tendency to declare wild type. All right, that people will carry out some evolution, test a bunch of clones, cherry pick the best clone, and declare that as their new wild type, their new founder molecule from which all further studies will proceed. And I think it's very dangerous from the point of view of what we know about evolution. But it's typical of sociology, though. People want to declare the molecule, characterize the heck out of it, publish it. So, yeah. It started with random 220, and you notice the final one was a little smaller than that. Okay, and that's because there were some sequences that were, if I go back here, so it was 220 random nucleotides. This is a little bit smaller. They made a deletion in this area because there was some unnecessary nucleotides. Ah, well, that's another good sociological question. And I've preached about this one in review articles and so on. Ad hoc. You know, so how does one decide how big a random sequence space one needs? Now, of course, realize, 220 random nucleotides, right? That's 4 to the 220th. That's, 220.6. It's 0.6 times 220. It's 10 to the 0.6 times 220, right? So it's about 140. 10 to the 140th possible sequences, okay? Yeah. So no one's making 10 to the 140th molecules. In fact, this library was 10 to the 14th. The largest library ever made, and Luke Yeager, who's on the faculty here at Santa Barbara, was a postdoc in my lab. He still holds the record. He made a 10 to the 17th library, but to do so, he did 1 liter PCR. Okay, he literally did PCR in 1 liter, and to do that, he had to clone his own thermostable polymerase and whip up a batch of it, and of course we were afraid to put it in a 1 liter vessel because we couldn't get the temperature right. So it was actually in 1,001 mL vessels. The poor guy, you know, his thumbs were sore. But anyway, so one could make 10 to the 17th, but that just scratches the surface of sequence space. Well, exactly, right? It's how many sequences you can represent, but what is the probability of finding a lead compound somewhere among those sequences? So, you know, as I say, how do people make this decision? It ends up being kind of ad hoc. They say, if it's an easy phenotype, well, then I don't need a big molecule. If I'm just looking for an RNA molecule that will bind to, some environmental toxin, right? People have made RNA molecules that light up, you name it, that binds to some environmental toxin, and that environmental toxin has a lot of shrubbery on it, a lot of amines and carboxylates, then they'll say, I'll just make random 35-mers. Okay? But if they say, I want an RNA molecule that is an aldolase that will make sugars, that must be hard. So I'm going to need at least 100 randoms, you know, and to make a polymerase, well, that's going to be 200. I don't know. There's not good discipline in the field to really ask what is the appropriate size randomization space that one should be looking at. And, of course, it's all constrained by how much you could physically represent. You really can't do 10 to the 17th library. 10 to the 15th is sort of the top of the comfort zone. 10 to the 16th, you know, is certainly doable. So that's the number of molecules you can even represent. Now, you might say, but, you know, if I have random 220 and I still can only have 10 to the 15th of them, within that 220 space, I have frames of 50. Right, so that's a kind of built-in complexity, and maybe it sort of poaches on different parts of the reading frame, puts those together, and doesn't literally use all 220, but has the opportunity to do so. There are a few cases in the field where people have said, well, let me do 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, make libraries of different complexity or different size random region, and throw them in parallel at the same problem. Some of that's been done, but again, we come to sociology. No one wants to be the one to make the same thing four times, you know. So it's hard to get people to do those studies, but it's a key question. Okay, let me move on though. I'm going backward here. Sorry. So you saw that. That's the selection scheme. Here's the catalyst. So then Bartel took this joining molecule and then put it in this new format where there's now an external template, right, and a primer, and now it's got to add individual pieces, and it gets rewarded for adding the last of those pieces, which contains the tag. And then he built, in fact, a polymerase. And I would say this is the high watermark right now, even though it was published in 2001, in constructing an RNA replicase. This is an RNA molecule, now 196 nucleotides, that out of that previously random accessory domain has now built a new, in an evolutionary sense, built a new domain that works together with the core domain to bring about the template-directed extension of a primer, adding NTPs, and doing so quite well. In the fidelity of addition is about 98.5% per addition. The maximum length of addition is 14. The rate of a single addition reaction is quite good, better than 1 a minute. Okay, that's the good news. And that's why I say this is the high watermark. The bad news. The bad news is the ability of the catalyst to dock in a productive manner, as reflected in KM, to dock the template primer complex into its active site is unmeasurably bad. So the KM isn't even known because it's very difficult for this molecule to grab this substrate. And so what happens is even though the catalytic rate is high, the T1 half for performing an addition reaction is something like 8 or 9 hours, because most of that time is waiting for a productive docking interaction, which happens on average every 8 or 9 hours. Once a productive docking occurs, the next residue is added, but then it becomes undocked and it's another 8 or 9 hours before it adds the next one. So in order to add 14 is a matter of days and days of incubation. But I've already told you how fragile RNA is, and I quoted rates at sort of neutral pH and a couple millimolar divalent metal. This thing operates at pH 8.5 and 200 millimolar magnesium, which is very harsh conditions for RNA. So by the time this RNA enzyme has done several addition reactions, it has largely degraded itself, or become degraded under those conditions. So that's a disadvantage. Yep? Yep.
So trying to liquid is
it's a good suggestion. So you'll see, though, as I say, this is the high water mark without that added difficulty. All right. But one could say, let me make at least a ligase, a joining enzyme, or maybe more, a polymerase, under more challenging prebiotic-like conditions. No one's done that because, you know, people don't like hitting themselves, you know. But that would be the next thing to try. But right now, everyone's focusing on generous conditions just to get things going. Well, yeah. So people have added cofactors, but well-chosen cofactors to help the RNA along, okay. But these conditions were actually chosen because they would promote the desired reaction. So this was sort of intelligent. No, I don't want to say that. This was a judicious choice by the experimenter to choose conditions that, knowing the chemistry, would promote that chemistry, but with the drawback that because this thing is so slow in productively docking the substrate, that it can't do many addition reactions before it degrades. And furthermore, and this is, I wouldn't say the dirty little secret of Bartel's paper, but isn't as widely known outside the field as inside the field, most templates don't function nearly that well. The typical addition is more like 4 or 5, all right? But, it's a proof of principle. Here is a ribozyme born of random sequence that in a template-directed manner with high fidelity adds monomers several in a row. And that's what you want, but a lot more of it. Yeah. Well, it's... That's great. That's a good question. So it's all about our signal to noise, all right? So although the signal is very faint as one starts to pull up this reaction, the noise is more faint because the uncatalyzed rate of this reaction is completely undetectable, all right? So as long as we have good stringency in our selection and the noise is very low, even if the signal is faint, we can enrich it. And once we begin to find catalysts that are maybe quite slow, quite weak, they become the parents, or that's becomes apparent, to then look for better and better catalysts. All right? The uncatalyzed reaction, right. So that, these are chemical molecules that will join on their own, or will join on a template, never mind the catalyst, at a measurable rate, but at a very slow rate. And so it's all a matter of selecting an encoded catalyst compared to the non-encoded background chemical reaction. Yeah. Well, you're right. You're absolutely right, yes. And I'm not going to show the example today, but... Yes. And I would say that particular compromise was biased by the particular choices that were made in this selection, which which at the time were very good, but I, you know, in retrospect led to these undesirable effects. I'm not going to talk about it other than to say that we did a similar program where we had a ligase that we then, in fact, it was the one that Luke Yeager made, a ligase that did a very nice job of joining, but then we wanted to join substrates on a separate template. And so we worked very hard to select for a good KM. We use tricks I won't go into, biochemical tricks, that put selection pressure more on KM than KCAT. And we ended up with a molecule that can do a joining reaction on a separate template with a KM of micromolar, of 1.6 micromolar. Very nice KM, but our rate isn't 1 a minute, it's about 0.07 a minute, you know, about 0.1, something like that. So we're down in rate. If we had our KM with Bartel's KCAT, we'd have a replicase. But that doesn't mean that it's possible, because you know, there's going to be trade-offs between these two constraints. Now let me move forward, though, because we're still back in old days, and things get better, believe me. But I want to just kind of, I think the questions show that you're ready for this, is kind of open up the mindset here a little bit and come back to this notion that we control the rules, right? There, you know, we banish clutter. We're now talking about how we control the selection constraint. You know, we can't know what is possible in sequence space until we run across it, but we can put the constraints on the system. Let's look at RNA itself, all right? So the four building blocks of RNA. What if we say that, you know, we're going to be overly tough on clutter elimination? We're going to eliminate one of the letters, all right? What if we just choose not to have C, all right? So let's play the same game. Only now there's no C. It's a world without C because it's our world. So there's an incoming piece, there's the triphosphate. Now actually the way we did this, and this is Jeff Rogers' work, former postdoc in my lab, there's two different random regions of 64 nucleotides each, but only A, U, and G in those random regions, no C. So there's no C anywhere in the system. Carry out the test tube evolution. Now we have a ligase with no Cs. All right, so it is a matter of what might be available. Now you suggested, what if we had more generous building blocks, you know? And we and others have looked at something beyond four. We've looked at adding a fifth. But I think it's instructive to think about what's the sort of minimum necessary for evolution to even make a stand. And here with no Cs, we have a ligase. It has a totally different shape. It has no Cs in it. It's made out of A's, U's, and G's. Of course, G can pair with C, but G can also form wobble pairs with U. So the G still has something to do in pairing with U. Maybe there's, you know, that's a reason why there's less G's, because there's no Watson-Crick pair, but there is a GU wobble pair and a way to make an architecture that gives us a catalyst that says, very nice KM, not a great KCAT, but hey, three letters. All right. So then Jeff said, well, this was a molecule that was born starting from random sequence, born in an evolutionary sense, in a world without C's. What if now we provide C's and change the game? Well, then we end up with a much better catalyst. So this is starting with the three-letter version I just showed you, and then from that point forward, bestowing C into the mix, allowing for the possibility of C, and you see that indeed it starts picking up C's, and it's somewhat changed the shape of this three-way junction, and of course made some sequence changes as well, and importantly, improved its catalytic rate about 20-fold. So four letters are better than three, but Darwinian evolution can find solutions even out of the three letters. And then the most perverse thing we did was two, right? Because two is the minimum. Now, you can't have information unless you have two different symbolic elements. So what if we just have A and U, no G or C, and let Darwinian evolution have at it and try to make an RNA joining enzyme? Okay, that didn't work. It didn't work, I think, for technical reasons. It's very hard, and I won't go into the technique of it, but it's very hard to do many rounds of PCR amplification with mixtures of nothing but A's and U's. It just makes a big mess in the PCR. So a little bit of a hedge that we did was we used 2-amino-A, what's called diaminopurine. All right. So this is sort of a hopped-up version of A that actually makes three hydrogen bonds with U. It's not as tight as a GC pair, but it's better than an AU pair, and it doesn't get into slippery, slidey mess that a big mix of A's and U's do. It's largely a folding problem. You know, if you have nothing but A and U in your polymer, you know, everything's pairing with everything, and they're all, you know, not the most stable pairs because they're AU pairs. Anyway, this helped a lot. So now we have diaminopurine, amino A, and U, and now we get a two-letter catalyst. All right, so nothing but D's, diaminopurines, and U's, and it's slower still. So the two-letter catalyst is about 20-fold slower than the three-letter catalyst, which is 20-fold slower than a four-letter catalyst. But, you know, this is the bottom. This is two symbolic elements doing the joining reaction. And the tribute here is really to Darwinian evolution and the ability to discover out of random sequence space solutions, even from a paucity of building blocks. You know, in the day before the discovery of catalytic RNA, despite Crick's suggestion, people said, oh, how could RNA really be a catalyst? It just has four building blocks. You know, it's not like proteins with 20. And those four building blocks, I showed you the structure, you know, they're very similar. You know, well, because evolution is a powerful thing. You know, here are two building blocks that are pretty similar in structure, but, you know, out comes a catalyst, albeit a slow one. Pardon me? Well, yeah, KM is kind of an artifice here. I think, you know, what this is really all about is this, it's the molecule really clamps down on the substrate quite well. It really does. You know, there must be, and we've had trouble analyzing the structure of this molecule because everything's so hypercomplementary. It must really wrap itself around the substrate. And we think that's because so much of this is avoiding alternative folds. So, you know, what we see is a substrate-induced fold, and so there's probably a lot of tertiary contacts around that substrate. But even holding it, you know, with a nanomolar KM, which is not ridiculous for an enzyme. We have other enzymes that have nanomolar KM. The rate is slow. You know, I think it's working hard to deal with the folding problem and grab the substrate productively, but it just doesn't have it just can't build a really complex, well-shaped active site. Although, I don't know, maybe we should keep evolving this thing and making it better and better, but John Reeder is now a professor at the University of North Carolina, so he's, and no one else wants to work on this thing. I'm only showing you secondary structures, not tertiary structures, and those are experimentally determined, and the details are in the paper. We do chemical and enzymatic probing. There is no tertiary structure of any of the molecules I'm showing you today. There's no crystal structure. Although there are crystal structures of some ribozymes. Okay, now, one more perverse thing, and you already brought this up, Doran, which is the difference between RNA and DNA. What puts the R in ribose is the 2' hydroxyl, right? If we make deoxyribose and pluck off that 2' hydroxyl, then we're DNA. All right, so I've shown you how the number of letters doesn't really matter. Evolution can find the problem. What about RNA itself? What about the difference between RNA and DNA? Does that really matter? Now let's go back to the four-letter version I showed you previously. So this is we call this the R3, random three-letter, R3/C ribozyme, because this is random three-letter and then add C back. So this R3C ribozyme has, you know, pretty nice rate, decent KM. It's a little different number than I showed before. I'm showing a different substrate up here. And it does this joining reaction. And it's an RNA catalyst that does RNA-RNA joining. If we change this to a DNA catalytic domain that would try to join two RNA substrates, no activity. And that's not surprising because, yes, it's just one atom on the sugar as well as a little change out in the base. Notice all the U's have become T's as well. But it's so much more than that, the difference between RNA and DNA. The pucker of the sugar in RNA is what's called C3' endo versus C2' endo in DNA, and that changes helical pitch parameters. Everything sort of changes just by pulling out that hydroxyl. It's not just a deletion of an atom. It has profound structural and chemical consequences. So here was a molecule that was evolved to be an RNA enzyme. Not surprising, even though, you know, one can one for one substitute the letters, that the DNA version has no activity. But Darwinian evolution then, given this DNA version with no activity, can then revive that activity in a DNA context. And so this is work of Natasha Paul in the lab. And what she did was carried out test tube evolution to now make a DNA enzyme out of the DNA version of the RNA enzyme that now brings about this joining reaction with pretty nice catalytic parameters. She didn't push really far on this, just to bring it, you know, within the ballpark of what the RNA enzyme could do. Now, interestingly, once you make the DNA version, which has picked up a variety of mutations shown here, to then pinch off into a different secondary structure compared to the RNA version, if you now take this DNA version and retrofit it as RNA, it's dead. Okay, and that's not surprising for reasons I said, as well as the fact that it's a somewhat different architecture here in the DNA form. But one can walk from RNA to DNA using Darwinian evolution as the mode. So we can think about different letters in the alphabet. We can think about different sugars. We can think about conversion from one sugar format to another. But all of this has a tediousness to it that you're not hearing so far in my talk. It did come up in your question, you know. I mean, I think the bottom line of your question is, you know, how hard is this stuff really to do? Okay, and I can show you all to do it, okay? You don't have to be a highly trained molecular biologist, biochemist, although some of you might be. You know, it's technique, but it has a tedium to it. And I think maybe more importantly, it has the wrong look and feel. It's very operator intensive, all this manipulation, you know. So there's a population of catalysts, and they're challenged to react and to, you know, pick up that tag. And then we select the tag molecules, right? And then we amplify the selected molecules and choose to introduce mutation. And so we're kind of working the process here quite a bit. But the right look and feel would be we would just have a pot, a test tube, a sterile test tube, and we would just put the population of RNAs in the test tube and we let them have at it. And after some amount of time, we would do a serial transfer and take an aliquot out of the previous test tube and put it into a fresh test tube, and so on and so on and so on. All right? So we could hope to culture a population of RNA enzymes in a more no-touch fashion. You know, or one could think of a flow reactor or something like that, rather than this sort of operator-intensive manipulation. That might pick up the pace and, as I say, maybe more importantly, remove this artificiality and this sort of time locking that occurs when one declares selection time over, time to go into amplification. And why is the time locking so important? Because if the molecules could just have at it, the moment they've completed their task or tasks, they start reproducing. And their progeny can then have at the task and so on. And so you build in a fecundity quotient, you know, or a fecundity multiplier. Your fecundity increases as your ability to perform the reaction increases, rather than sort of being time-locked, waiting for the master from the outside to separate the haves from the have-nots. So we call this continuous in vitro evolution, and it started about 10 years ago, but there's some new twists that I'm going to come to. And I don't want to go too much through the technique, but enough so you get what the basic parts are. So here's a ribozyme, and what I'm going to show you is starting with that class 1 ligase of Bartel and Shostak, and it performs this joining reaction. Only now we're going to give it a very special substrate coded with two colors here. The color code is orange is RNA, blue is DNA, just like in the previous slides where I showed you a ribozyme in orange turning into a deoxyribozyme in blue. So this is a substrate that's got some ribonucleotides at the end and some DNA upstream, and that DNA is very special. It's a signal sequence for a promoter element for a polymerase protein. All right, so ribozymes are challenged to join that substrate, release two phosphates, and form this phosphodiester linkage. In the mixture is a primer for cDNA synthesis that binds to the end of the RNA molecules, whether they've reacted or not, and a protein enzyme, reverse transcriptase, and the building blocks of DNA that then cause that primer to become extended. Now, if the molecules haven't reacted, then this is not present, right? And so the extension quits at this position. But if the molecules have reacted before the primer binds and becomes extended, then the extension reads through the joining site and reads all the way through that attached promoter sequence, making both strands of a promoter sequence. A promoter only works when it's double-stranded. So if and only if the molecules have reacted before they got reverse transcribed, do they produce a RNA-DNA chimeric product that has a functional promoter, which in the presence of the corresponding RNA polymerase then makes 10 or more copies of RNA progeny. And those progeny are born with their triphosphate on because they're made out of NTPs, the first NTP at the 5' end bearing its triphosphate. So they're born ready to react again, and so on and so on and so on. Okay? So that's continuous in vitro evolution, and the idea is we're just going to take, and now I'm going to be literal here, 25 microliter solution, put a population of ribozymes into that 25 microliter solution. Now it's a complex media. It contains that special substrate I showed you, the reverse transcriptase primer, the ribo and deoxy NTPs, the protein enzymes, reverse transcriptase, and RNA polymerase, some salts, and so on, and it's buffered pH, and all those goodies. All right, so it's a complex media, but of course it's nowhere near as complex as the media one would need in order to culture, say, bacteria or eukaryotic cells. This is culture media for ribozymes. So in that 25 microliters are these materials. The population of ribozymes is added to the media. Some interval of time is allowed, and then one takes a small aliquot, and we're going to use an example I'm going to show, 1/1000th of this material, and transfer it to a fresh mixture of media and carry out serial transfer. Okay? And we can just track this over time. Now, this is time in hours, in real hours, although, as I'll mention, it's not time without sleep. This is Martin Wright, a former postdoc. He did not carry out this experiment 50 hours without sleep. He did pause, and you'll see his pauses. and we're going to track the amount of RNA in the tube, tube by tube. All right? And so he starts out with 20 nanomolar ribozyme input in that 25 microliter volume, lets them have at it for about an hour, and there's about tenfold net amplification, and then he takes a 1 to 1,000 dilution. Then he lets them have at it for another hour, there's about almost 100-fold amplification, and then another 1,000 to 1 dilution. So this is on the way to extinction here, but evolution begins to work because some variants in that pot amplify faster, perform the reaction faster, and therefore amplify faster than their brethren, and they begin to dominate the mixture. So that in that third hour, he does better than 1,000-fold amplification, and now when he does 1 to 1,000 dilution, he's actually gained a little bit, and so extinction was avoided, and then the process becomes infinite. So as long as one cares to do this, one can keep culturing this population of enzymes. Now, as you can see, what he actually did was he worked about 12 hours and then went home. And this is, he put the molecules in the freezer, and they were a little sluggish coming out of the freezer the next morning, and that's the second morning, and then there's some other variability in here. You also notice the time is getting shorter and shorter between 1,000-fold dilutions because the molecules are getting better and better. All right, or I should say, the molecules that are prevalent in the population are better than those prevalent in the population at earlier times. They need less time to achieve 1,000-fold amplification, and so the time between transfers can be progressively cut. Although you can see a lot of these decisions are being made kind of ad hoc, you know, 1 hour, then 30 minutes, then 15 minutes. He just sort of decided, well, it's time now. It's been a few days. We'll give him only 15 minutes from here on. Now, of course, this is evolution in real time. We have it all. We have every little tube, as well as the last one, sitting in a freezer. So we can thaw any tube. We can analyze what's in the tube. We can clone out individuals, determine their sequence, analyze their function, and reconstruct what happened. So here's what happened. This is the starting ligase from Bartel. Actually, this is a little different version than what I showed you previously, although now I'm showing you the whole sequence that Eklund and Bartel developed subsequent to what I showed you previously. So that was what went in at this point. And then I'll show you what came out after 100 transfers of 1,000-fold dilution each time. So 300 logs of dilution. These molecules withstood that, in an evolutionary sense. So that was the starting ligase. And this is one 30 mutations later that emerged out the back end and had a marked improvement, about a 10 to the 5th fold improvement in catalytic efficiency compared to what went in. Better KM, better KCAT, given the conditions. It actually lengthened the template region. It made a nucleotide change here to pick up a 7th and 8th base pair to better hold on to that substrate, and that was part of how it improved KM. It did some change this base pair so that it improved KCAT thanks to AA stacking and made some other changes I won't discuss. So that happened over those 100 hours, the 300 logs of total logs of dilution. But, you know, really we don't just want a joining reaction. We want to fill a gap with multiple joining reactions. We'd like NTPs to fill the gap, and the NTPs, remember, already in the broth. They're part of the media because they're needed to make the RNA enzyme itself. We'd like the molecules to do multiple joining reactions. So this is work of Kathleen McGinnis in the continuous evolution format, asking them to add one NTP and then join themselves onto the end, and then add two NTPs and join themselves onto the end. So this is now, through continuous evolution, coaxing these molecules to be more of a polymerase than a simple joining enzyme. Now here you see the gaps. Not only are those times when she went to sleep, but there's an issue when you do this much evolution, you know, many, many transfers, many logs of net dilution, that the diversity in the population is sucked out. All right, there's such stringent selection pressure, and the multiplier effect works so well that if we did nothing but just let the culture run, we would not have a lot of diversity after some number of transfers, which means less search space for advantageous individuals. So taking advantage of the fact that Kathleen had to go home and sleep, at night we would run mutagenic PCR. So these are the times where mutagenic PCR occurred to re-inject diversity into the population before proceeding the next morning and sort of balance reduction of diversity through selection with introduction of diversity through mutation. It's not an ideal balance, and these days we use other techniques that are more more on-the-fly ways of introducing diversity rather than sort of stepping out of the system. But that was the goal, was to maintain diversity. Now, of course, again, we can look at what we have here. This is the molecule I showed you previously that had the extended template and now the AA positioning here. So that does simple ligation. This is a dominant individual from the population at the time when they had gotten well adapted to doing one NTP addition. It chose to add a UTP on a templated A. That A didn't used to be there. It mutated to A to choose a U for a subtle molecular biological reason I probably won't go into. It has to do with promoter efficiency. And here's the one that adds two NTPs, wisely, in retrospect, slotting a GC pair in here to help with stability of forming that complex. So, you know, we can track this. Now, this is as far as this particular lineage has gone. Yep. All changes. These are the changes relative to the previous. Yeah, so I can't tell you what all the changes are, but I can tell you what many of them are. So this one, this G change here has to do with then making this a GC pair for better template occupancy. These changes here, which actually flipped base pairs, so that you can't just make one change, you got to make both changes to maintain Watson-Crick pairing. This helps in folding, and it increases the fraction of molecules that are properly folded in the population, and so that's a net benefit for fitness. These changes out here, these addition of U's, we think that actually has to do with slowing down a bit the rate of reverse transcription, giving the molecules just a little more time to get the reaction done before they get inactivated by reverse transcription. These also contribute to folding. This one, we're not sure what that's about. This one contributes to KCAT. This one is a neutral. Okay. This is a UNCG. It's a special motif in RNA that closes off a stem. It's a special stable loop that has the form UNCG, where this is U, this can be any base, C or G. So that's a fairly pure neutral there because that can be any base. So we can try to decode these to the amount of energy we have to throw at the problem. Yeah. At a lower level, yeah, and so there are other techniques for doing insertion deletions. I would say that aren't that good. There really is no good technique in the field now for doing pure insertions and deletions, other than in making an initial library. But on the fly, we get so our mutagenic PCR technique gives us 0.7% substitution per position after running the process. All right, which is about right for the size of our molecule. And it was carefully tuned to give, to statistical tests, equal probability of transitions and transversions, the different types of mutations. But it's about 0.02% insertion and deletion. So the way test tube evolution of RNA leads to insertions and deletions is more through recombination events, through template switching by the polymerases that then miss at the time of template switch. But it's not a well-controlled process. So that is, I would say, a flaw in the technology right now that we'd like to get past. Okay, well, that's a particular example, and this one, this lineage has gone other places. We've made used continuous evolution to make high pH versions that work at pH 9.5, low pH versions that work at pH 4.5, versions that can withstand attack by a ribonuclease. What else? Versions that work in lower concentrations of divalent metal, a version that works in a different metal, all kinds of different tricks. But all this is beholding to that class 1 ligase that I showed before, and until very recently, and I mean very recently, just in the past few months, that was the only game in town. There's another ribozyme that does a joining reaction. It was developed by Tan Inoue and colleagues at Kyoto University, and it was developed kind of for a different purpose in mind, to show sort of modular assembly of a catalyst. But the bottom line is there's many of these ligase ribozymes out there. There's probably a dozen of them by now in the literature. But we liked this one a lot when we saw this paper come out in 2004 in PNAS, because here's a case where the template is already separate from the catalytic domain. We also noted how much it looks like our R3C, not just superficially. There's a lot of resemblance. I mean, I consider them sort of, I don't want to say convergent evolution, but they're sort of cousins in a sense to our independent cousins. I guess that's... You can't say something like that. They look a lot alike. How about that? You know, both in secondary structure and in some of the sequence features to the R3C ribozyme, as well as another one developed by Andy Ellington called the L1 ligase ribozyme, all have this kind of three-way junction architecture. But what's really interesting about this one is the template is already separate. Now, there's this complex triple helix domain that makes the connection to that separate template. And that's part of what the goal of this paper was. They started with this triple helix domain and these domains out here, and then put random nucleotides on the back of that structure and watch the catalyst appear. So that's what I mean by modular development of a catalyst. DSL stands for designed and selected ligase. So they designed this triple helix domain and this special receptor domain out here, but then selected on the back of that domain to get this ligase. But what intrigued us was the template is sort of separatized from the catalytic domain. It forms a 3,5-phosphodiester. The rate is terrible. You know, it's less than 0.1 a minute. It's general with respect to sequence. We thought this was an interesting molecule to play with. And in particular, we felt that the continuous evolution process with the descendants and distant descendants of the class 1 ligase was getting a little lonely and a little monolithic. It was all, you could connect through one grand lineage all of those papers, all of those studies, and we thought this might be another opportunity to get into the continuous evolution game. But it's not a good catalyst like the one developed by Bartel and Shostak. So some work had to be done. Sarah Wojtek, and this is unpublished, this is very new stuff, a graduate student in the lab said, well, first thing we have to do is get rid of that triple helix domain and just connect the template via a flexible oligo-U tether so that it's as if it's a separate molecule, giving a kind of pseudo-intermolecular feel. Now, that killed the activity, okay? But then she did some stepwise test tube evolution, made some changes in the catalyst, a couple little changes in the tether, which turned out not to be critical, but changes in the catalyst to now operate slowly, but on this flexibly tethered template substrate complex. Then she added 35 random nucleotides out at this distal position because we need more rate. We need a better catalyst. So we need more sequence space, and this is where it does get ad hoc. You know, why did we choose 35? You know, why didn't we make this 220? Well, because ultimately we want this thing to replicate itself, so we don't want it to be too big. Why didn't we make it 20? Well, we felt 20 wouldn't be enough to kind of reach around to the active site being placed on this distal stem. So, you know, and there are also some technical issues why it was technically easy to make a library with 35. And why did we put it here? Biochemical reasons. So it was an ad hoc choice, hopefully defendable. So she did that, put 35 random nucleotides, carried out more stepwise evolution, and now we've got a pretty good catalyst. Notice I'm not showing the structure here. This week she's actually doing the chemical probing to understand. I mean, I can see what I think is a little stem in there, but until we prove it, I'm not going to show it. So this is no longer a random sequence. It's a particular sequence, and of course there's many variants in the population, and we learned something about structure by sequence comparison, but ultimately we have to do experimental analysis to know what this region is shaped like. But it's a particular sequence, and now the rate's pretty good with this flexible tether. So now we're ready for continuous evolution. So here we go. You know what this looks like now. We're starting with a catalyst that's about 0.35 a minute, which is a little dicey because the reverse transcriptase is going to come in at about 1 a minute for rate of initiation, reverse transcription. So the molecules better get their act together pretty quick or it's going to be extinction time. But indeed, we have another one of these kind of traces now from a completely separate initiation. And this just happened, as I said, last October, November. It was, you know, really shaky at the start, but it's gotten quite good. And so that's where we are on this continuous evolution lineage. And now, and I don't have data to show because these are really recent experiments just in the last week. Now we have two independent species, if you will, two continuously evolving things, each with a completely independent heritage. Let's put them together. Right, let's start doing molecular ecology. Now, there's an interesting little side piece here. The substrate that was used to train the class 1 ligase to the point it could undergo continuous evolution had a little tag sequence upstream of the promoter that we used for cloning purposes and analysis. The DSL ligase ribozyme that now is undergoing continuous evolution has a different little upstream tag piece. We put a different sequence up there so that we could distinguish the two and avoid cross-contamination in the lab. They each love their own little substrate. All right? They've developed some subtle little tertiary contacts with their own little substrate. If you give the class 1 continuously evolving ribozyme the substrate for the DSL, it can react with it, but it's hugely down in rate, about 50 to 100-fold down in rate, depending on conditions, and vice versa. So they each have their own preferred substrate. So just about a week ago, we developed what we call the universal substrate, which has no tag sequence upstream, has a little sort of consensus tag, and both continuously evolving ribozymes like it equally. All right, so it's a fair fight. So we now have a substrate that can be a limiting resource for two continuously evolving ribozymes present in the same reaction mixture, continuously evolving in the same reaction mixture. Last week we took them out for a little cruise together, but just from the wild type, just from the defined clone of the DSL and defined clone of the class 1, they went out for a walk together and they got along fine for several logs of growth. This week, randomized versions thereof are going into battle. And we'll see, you know, what'll happen. So it could be that one of them just wins and that's it, you know. It could be that one of them more or less wins, but the other one putters along at a very low level. Now, of course, what we're and we could stack the deck, but at first we don't want to stack the deck. We just want to see what happens because, of course, what we're very interested to see is whether something interesting and emergent happens. Like, you know, I mean, I don't imagine they're both just going to hum along an equal representation in the population. But one might be winning quite a bit, but the other one is under intense selection pressure, you know, in any case. And maybe the first one kind of digs itself into a deep local fitness optimum while the other one is poking about, and maybe it discovers something and takes over. I mean, we would love to see sort of natural, you know, ebb and flow of two competing individuals. I don't know. I don't know how realistic that is, but it's certainly possible to do scads of evolution. So we could look at that and do many replicates and so on. The other thing we can do, of course, is stack the deck. We know the structure of both of these molecules, although with DSL we still need to know the structure of that little bottom loop. We can make them cooperate, and we can make them compete. Now, how do we make them cooperate? So they all have stems and loops in them that are necessary for function. We can complete the stem of one from sequence supplied by the other, and vice versa. Right? So we can so-called domain swap and require them to benefit from each other. Now, you can imagine escape mechanisms. They may say, I don't need your help. I'll invent my own way around that. But we can play that kind of game. And we can also induce competition because we can put a domain in one that is a competitive inhibitor for the other through Watson-Crick pairing, so-called antisense pairing, and vice versa. So, very literally, just in the last you know, couple of weeks, we are now poised to start doing that continuous evolution in molecular ecology and see what happens. But there's still one missing piece, and that is there's still a tedium to this. You know, there's what we call pipette monkey. All right, so Sarah goes into pipette monkey mode, which is, you know, there's a human that is doing all these, you know, pull out an aliquot, make a dilution, squirt to the next one, do the analysis, and it's ragged too. You can see how. We have, you know, and for I mean, the first continuous evolution paper is 10 years ago almost now, and people said to me, they didn't say it quite that way, but they said, you know, have you heard about it? And I said yes. You know, that's not really what we're after for several reasons. I don't like the scale, although one could do that on a small scale, because to really go longitudinal, the reagents get quite expensive, so I'd like a smaller scale. The precision, I think, is there. The cross-contamination problem is huge. Andy Ellington at the University of Texas, maybe 8 years ago, made a robot to develop aptamers, RNA aptamers. And I know from visiting Andy's lab and talking to Andy, that robot gathers dust because, you know, it takes more work to keep the robot behaving than just to do the work. All right, so I was happily avoided the whole robotic era. But there's a different era that we've jumped onto, and that's microfluidics. Okay, so I'm going to end with what is the very latest in test tube evolution, I think, that really lets us put the pedal to the metal. All right, so I'm not going to go through microfluidics. Hopefully you know something about it. I just want to give you a little bit of an introduction to the primitives we use and the basic circuitry. Remember, all we have to do is, when the time comes, when the population reaches a certain number of individuals, the equivalent of drawing up an aliquot and preparing a dilution for squirting into a new reaction vessel has to happen, all right? Although we want that to happen precisely, in an automated fashion, computer-controlled, you know, we can set the variables how we want. So just a little bit about microfluidics. The primitive here is just fluidic channels that are under vacuum control. So we have a three-layer device. There's two glass layers shown in light blue here, and there's a PDMS, a clear rubberized membrane, polydimethylsilane membrane in between the two glass layers. All right, one can etch using standard lithography techniques, photolithography techniques. One can etch into the glass layer's channels. The top glass layer is going to be the fluidic layer, and so the channels will carry fluid. The bottom glass will be the vacuum layer, and it will carry, it will have vacuum pressure to pucker the membrane that lies between. So this is a channel from left to right. in a closed state where there's a discontinuity between this portion of the channel and that. So fluid flows in, it hits the discontinuity and stops. If we apply vacuum to the vacuum channel at that position, it will pucker the PDMS membrane, open up the discontinuity, and fluid flows. All right, so that's the basic principle. That's been around in microfluidics for, you know, 8, 10 years or so now. And it's the primitive of what we're trying to do. But here's our fundamental circuit. It's called a mixing loop. So we have three such channels, about one centimeter diameter, and three places of discontinuity. Valves at each of those places, which we're going to call pumping valves, A, B, and C. And the idea is to sequentially activate those valves to pump fluid around the loop. So that's mix. Okay, that's when new things are added. And even at idle time, we kind of keep a slow mix going just to keep everything percolating around in laminar flow. So that's the pumping valves. We have an input reservoir and an output reservoir, which is a fraction collector. The input reservoir are all the goodies in the media that I showed you previously. It's the timing of when the valves activate. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, see, now why is it, I've had that question before, I don't see why that's a showstopper. To me, I understand that we're under laminar flow in these channels with sequential activation, ABC, ABC, ABC. That to me, why doesn't it go backwards?
What makes the laminar flow? Why does it go at all?
See, now, why is that, to me, it's counterintuitive to worry that it wouldn't go at all. I mean, it's like squeezing sausage, huh? It's, I mean...
That's why you have three
and not two. If you had two, it would reciprocate. But if you have three, it goes pop up. It's like, yeah, imagine a tube of sausage and you're doing this, you know? It's a peristaltic pump. Well, no. Okay, you guys are the physicists, you know, so I someone else asked me that because this is, I think, the third time I've talked about this. I guess I'm going to have to think more about it, but to me, it doesn't bother me. You know, if there were two, it would bother me a lot because it wouldn't know which end was up. Okay, well, it works. Okay, I'm going to show you a movie. It works. And then we have input chamber, which is all the media, output chamber, which is a fraction collector, and those meet the mixing loop via a bus valve. All right, so the mixing loop is always patent at these positions, but the bus valve, when open, then allows this line to contact the mixing loop and similarly for the output. Okay? And then that's what things look like in the fluidic layer on top. Then in the vacuum layer on the bottom, there are these channels that run through the vacuum layer and come into contact with the different valve positions. And then at the end of these are little actuators that draw vacuum on whatever line is supposed to have vacuum. As I said, it's a centimeter across, 400 nanoliter volume in the loop. This allows us population sizes of evolving RNA molecules of 10 to the 9th-ish or so. That's less than we would do in bulk reaction, but as you'll see, we can do scads of evolution with this. Now, the device itself was just published at the end of 2006, in December 2006, in Analytical Chemistry. And that paper doesn't really talk about evolution except one or two sentences in the intro and at the end of the discussion. That's obviously why we built it. But for the analytical chemistry world, it's all about performance metrics and, you know, and all that. So we wrote a very technical paper on the device itself because no one has made a serial dilution device before in microfluidics. So the way it works is this, and I'm showing you now a movie with fluorescent dye in here so you can see what happens. First comes the place in which we're going to draw something up into the pipette, so to speak. We leave valve C closed, and pump sort of around the back end of the loop. And this one, I think you can see the directionality because we're drawing in buffer and we're evacuating the back half of the loop, isolating a slug between the input and output positions. Okay, so that was a real-time movie with fluorescent dye. So now we've sucked something up in the pipette. Now we bring in fresh reagent and we carry out our dilution. This is a 1-6 loop. We typically use a 1-10 loop. It just has to do with the positioning of the valves, right? The amount of volume in here relative to the entire loop. Actually, this is a 1-5.5 loop. But we typically do a 1/10, you know, a 10-to-1 dilution. And so it dilutes out nicely. Yeah, it does go around. See, I don't know. I guess I'm just used to seeing it from the very beginning. You get a little puff when the valve opens because it sort of expands that position a bit. But so that's the basic operation. Now, it's a scratch-built device. Brian Pagel, a postdoc in the lab, scratch-built a laser confocal microscope. Now, what you're seeing here is an aluminum plate. So that plate has a thermocouple on it, and that's just to maintain constant temperature of typically 37 C. On top of the plate, I think you can see the glass wafer, right, which is about 5-inch diameter wafer, you know, about a half a centimeter thick, something like that. And then, this is an older picture. This is a fraction collector now, but here it's just a vial. That's the output line. The input line, we actually have two different tubes. We like to keep the enzymes, the polymerase enzymes, reverse transcriptase and RNA polymerase, separate from the other materials so that the polymerases don't start, you know, idle hands of the devil's workshop, start making some weird polymers on us. So the polymerases are in one tube. The small molecules are in another. They meet actually just in time at the input port on the device. And these are the vacuum lines. So here at the end are where the vacuum channels come out, and these are the lines that go off to an actuator that can pop open the valves, as you saw. The laser confocal's off screen, but it feeds up through the objective here and is trained on... the chip has many circuits on it, but we typically train on one of the circuits. So we can operate many circuits in parallel. If we were really fancy, we'd have a laser that would be scanning across the chip and read multiple circuits, but we haven't spent that money yet. And we use a dye called oxazole yellow, which intercalates with an RNA and allows us to then read how much RNA is in the mix. All right, so now, and this is just, I should have shown you this. So you can see the chip better here. There's the chip. You know, these are, as I say, the vacuum lines, and here comes input. These are different positions at which we bring input or pull output from the chip from different circuits that are on the chip. The chip, as I said, is about 5 inches across, but each little circuit's only a centimeter, so there's several of them up and down the chip here. And by the way, once you develop the design for this, which Brian did, then it's about $7 a pop to keep stamping out these chips. All right. So furthermore, we're conserving on reagents because of our volume here. But most importantly, there's a precision to it, all right? So now I'm going to show you actual RNA evolution on a chip. This is the class 1 ligase. The DSL is newly continuously evolving and hasn't hit chip yet. It's only been in test tube, but it will get chip time soon. So this is time in minutes, and the way this is done is we just set a threshold and say when the population of RNA gets to a certain concentration based on how much fluorescent signal from the intercalating dye, then activate the process I just showed you in the movies of isolating an aliquot and carrying out the dilution. And this just really runs. Okay, so this is one in which we weren't really changing conditions at all. We just kept it same pH, same magnesium concentration, same substrate concentration. So, but this is more kind of a standardizing run. There, you know, there's a little bit of glitches once in a while. There might be a little micro bubble, and we put a little detergent in there. But it's pretty good. You know, it's nothing like the traces I showed you before. And as far as deciding how long before the next transfer. You know, the computer decides. It's triggered by threshold rather than by a decision on the part of experimenter. I feel like doing 30-minute transfers today. So that's basically where we are in this game. You know, I think you see what the technology has. The big question is, what can the molecules do for us? I don't know how much evolution it's going to take to coax a ligase to a polymerase, ultimately to a replicase. But if it takes thousands of generations, we can do it now, without too much tedium or too much expense. And even if we, even belaying that happy day, you know, we now have a very powerful technology for just studying evolution of RNA, for putting populations of RNA in motion under different selection constraints. Now, for the first time, two different species, so to speak, in competition together. So the game is on. You know, that's what we're up to. Okay. The people that do this work gets funded. I didn't talk about it, but there is an NIH spin-off on this. We have actually evolved molecules for profit, not just for fun. So there are mostly DNA molecules, DNA enzymes that are used in diagnostic kits as biosensors, and have actually been used as knockout agents in whole animals. NASA used to fund this work. NASA has had a long hiatus on funding astroexobiology work, but they seem to be on the brink of getting back into the game. And NSF funded the microfluidics work. Actually, it was, as you can tell from the device, it was sort of skunk work, you know, self-funded until it got to the point of producing some kind of data. But just within the last 6 months, NSF has picked up on that. So we're enjoying some funding from them. And the ligase ribozymes, Jeff Rogers did the three-letter thing that I talked about, the R3 and the R3C. John Reeder did the two-letter. Natasha Paul made the DNA version. Martin Wright was the first person to do the continuous evolution. Then Kathleen McGinnis made it add 1 NTP, 2 NTPs. And then Sarah Wojtek is the new one, the DSL ligase, continuously evolving. And all the microfluidics work is Brian Pagel, a postdoc. former Berkeley grad student. So, okay, that's what I want to cover. Happy to take questions. Yeah. Yeah. Good question. It's a good question. So I would say no one has done a definitive study of population size. So just like the question, how big should our random region be? The question of how big should our population be has to do with how much money are we going to spend and time making it. Okay. So no one's doing a 10 to the 17th since Luke did it back in the late 90s. Most people do a 10 to the 15th because that's a kind of typical 1 mil reaction in a starting population. But as people nurse the population round after round, they typically come in at about 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 12th, because it's just a cost versus convenience issue. You know, we're now going to have to live at 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 10th if we're in microfluidics. You say, well, that's a penalty. You know, so the trade-off is going to be, if you can do twice as many, or I think realistically, 10 times as many rounds of evolution per unit real-world time, but suffer a population, a decreased population size by 2 logs, do you come out ahead or not? My belief is you could come out way ahead, okay? People that do protein evolution in vitro never work with populations as big as even what we're doing in the microfluidic chip because of limitations on cellular transformation. So those are 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th, best case 10 to the 9th, you know. But you could say, yeah, but those are proteins. You know, so they're much better at doing things. Yeah, but you know, their sequence space is much more complicated. It's, you know, it's 20 to the length of the... So, I don't know. It's a good question, and you know, you can't both be microfluidic and scaled up at the same time. We can run 10 circuits at once, so we can pick up a log right there. You know, and maybe we should ask the question, does it really benefit? But, you know, my intuition is, based on things we've done, to be able to do many, many more generations, you know, and live with a population size that's only, quote-unquote, only 10 to the 9th, I think we're going to win. But it's a good question. It really should be looked at formally. Yeah. Yeah, good question. All right, so there's been very little of that, okay? Years ago, a former postdoc in the lab named Niles Lehman did a little, just went out a few rounds of evolution. This was a RNA enzyme that we had taught to cleave DNA, and he sort of discovered the same little favorite set of mutations. Now, more recently, Niles has published a paper on the topic of recurrence using the continuous evolution system and the class 1 ligase. He launched 13 lineages simultaneously, and he got the same solution across the board, the same basic constellation of mutations. It's called the B16-19 constellation, plus some other neutral to minor benefit mutations on the side. And you know, and so he makes a discussion about this as a strong local attractor, deep fitness optimum, and all that. There's a serious concern, and I'm not saying that this is, you know, I wouldn't say this even if it wasn't being recorded. I'm not saying there's a problem with Niles' paper, but it's something you have to be very concerned about, is that it's not recurrence, but it's cross-contamination. All right. And when I said how when we started messing with the DSL ligase toward continuous evolution, we changed the little tag sequence, we know from experience that despite remarkably good practice, I mean, the kind of practice that's used in diagnostic labs, you know, one-way flow, destruction of materials, you know, barrier, all that stuff. You know, because some of the most advantageous molecules are so advantageous, you know, one of them floats on by and whoosh, takes over the population. So that's been a complication for recurrence studies. And I think the chip gives us an opportunity there, because the chip is a sealed system. Okay, when you're on chip, you know, you are physically isolated from the world and from your neighbors. Now, I don't think we can do many of those type of experiments, because then our previous experimental history will cloud our future. But we are planning on doing, you know, a more definitive recurrence study with the circuits literally running in parallel, you know, from time lock zero. So, you know, but as I say, it's an understudied problem. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
How does the approach this? It's always kind of approaches one species of
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
What
Yeah, so and actually the way we score fitness isn't by the, and you know, we call them zigzag plots too, or did I say that out loud? You know, we call them zigzag plots. And you're right, the, you know, as the periodicity shortens, that's an indication of increasing fitness. But the way we actually measure fitness is, actually there's two ways we measure fitness. I think the most important one is we do a growth curve on a clone, all right? So, I mean, I could pull some up on my computer, but we plot, you know, number of copies of RNA versus time, and we get a beautiful logistic curve. I mean, it fits beautifully. The question is just what's the exponential growth rate, right? And so the exponential growth rate on a fit to a logistic curve for a clone, to me, is the best measure of fitness, all right? Now well, you say, of course, I think that, but biochemists say, well, but what's the KCAT? I don't care what the growth rate is. That's, you know, that's a phenomenological effect, right? So another measure of fitness, and that's why I stopped myself and said we actually have two measures of fitness, is, you know, we do know the catalytic parameters. What's KCAT? What's KM? So what happens, though, to get to your question, is, you know, it doesn't just keep getting better and better, because eventually there's no more headroom given the constellation of events that take place within continuous evolution, right? So there's room above it, until you get to the point where you're limiting for being amplified by the polymerase machinery. So we can run up to that, but what we'd like to do is re-challenge the population, right? So, you know, like the last one I showed where we're on chip, that was already nicely optimized and it was just running at full speed, okay? In order to evolve, we have to create struggle, right? And so we do things like, as I said, raise the pH progressively or lower the pH. We are working on KM now, so we're dropping the substrate concentration down and down. And so it's now, for the first time, really having to fight for KM. Now there's some issues there because, and this comes to population size. And this is why, by the way, another reason I'm comfortable at 10 to the ninth. You can't drop the substrate concentration down so low that you become substrate limited relative to the number of molecules in the population. You know, so we can't say, well, let's go attomolar substrate concentration, because then we would have a population size that was subattomolar. So there'd still be at least, you know, I guess you could. You could have a very rare number of substrate molecules, and then you're selecting for on rate, right? Because once you grab substrate, you win. So then it's an on-rate selection rather than a KM selection. But to have a KM selection, we have to have more substrate molecules than individuals in the population. So that's another reason why I'm actually okay being a 10 to the 9th, because we want to get to nanomolar in KM. So that's another way to put pressure. We can put inhibitors in there. All these kinds of things have been done. But if you just let it run, it does hit its, it tops off with the headroom that the system gives us. Yeah. Well, because, so what I actually want is I want the enzyme to grab the template primer complex, you know, with a very good KM, okay, and be possessive, therefore, you know, so that, well, okay, what I don't want is a complete release of the template primer complex. What I would like would be possession within the active site. So now if, so I don't want nanomolar KM for the complete quaternary complex of enzyme, template, primer, and NTP, all right? But I do want a really good KM for the ternary complex of enzyme, template, primer, and then have the NTP be the thing that leads to processivity. And I should say, I'm not going to say because the camera's on. I was going to say what we're really doing, you know, which is we're not using NTPs anymore. All right? I guess enough of this is in our more recent papers. People would guess this is what we're doing. So, I think the ideal substrate, again, not from a prebiotic sense, but from a let's just build it, the ideal substrate to me is a trinucleotide, not a mononucleotide. Because I don't want to fight for template occupancy, right? I don't want to depend on the affinity of a monomer for its template, which is typically millimolar, I mean, it depends if it's AU or GC. And I don't want to consolidate, just what you said, Doran, I don't want to consolidate too much on that, right? Because I want to process. So I want binding the incoming piece to be fairly easy. But I don't want to join, say, tenmers together, because then I'll have a fidelity problem. If there's mismatch in the middle of a tenmer, it'll be very hard to deal with that. You know, plus 4 to the 10th, 10 to the 6th tenmers. That'll be my population of substrates. So we've, through experimentation, and you know, and of course, first principle, but mostly through experimentation, we've come down to trimers, trinucleotides, as our substrate. It gives us the middle position as kind of a joker position to put tags on, 5' position for triphosphate, the 3' position for hydroxyl, the middle position, the tag. A trinucleotide binds micromolarish, which is pretty fine. Depends on the AUGC amount. The only problem was, how do you make a trinucleotide with a triphosphate on it? So, you know, we also are chemists, and so we developed a synthetic methodology that was just published last year, how to chemically put a triphosphate on any oligo you want, RNA or DNA. So actually what we do now is our substrate toward a polymerase is a trinucleotide 5' triphosphate. There, I've said it on camera. Okay. You were up first, I think. Yeah, probably true. Well, so when we did this, this technique was published back in 92. And we wanted to have something that was, you know, it was very important for us to have not a lot of sequence bias so that we could have a broad exploration of sequence space. And with a lot of fiddling, and in those days, much more tedious sequence analysis, we came up with a particular approach. But what if we want a higher rate or a lower rate? We were never able to come up with a technique that could give us a higher rate. So lower, we really don't need lower, but to give us a higher rate that didn't give us some sequence bias. Now, there is a method published by Simon Wayne Hobson where he can get up to 10% mutation frequency per position over the course of what he calls hypermutagenic PCR. But it's essentially all wobble mutations. And we used that technique. We used it in the development of the DSL ligase to the point of it getting as good as it got. We did hypermutagenic PCR many times. I didn't explain that. And we just accepted the fact that it's almost all transition mutations. But there really isn't an ideal technique that lets you sort of dial in the mutation frequency without giving you that bias. We will run our mutagenic PCR to get 0.67% mutation frequency. We will run it twice in a row to double that. It's hard to run it three times in a row because you have a founder effect problem as you, unless you really blow up the volume to a 1 liter PCR in the third one. What we are working on now is what we call online mutagenesis in the context of continuous evolution, where Katie Petrie, a student in the lab, is doing this, where we have nucleotide analogs that introduce different types of mutations, and we're developing different cocktails that try to standardize the mutation probability across the different types of mutations. It's pretty tricky, actually. It's very sensitive to things like little perturbations of divalent concentration will make it easier to make one kind of mutation, harder to make another. You know, the first issue is making the mismatch, and there's a whole set of parameters, you know, chemical parameters and biochemical parameters that affect that. But then a whole different set is extending a mismatched position, right? It's one thing to cause a mismatch to happen, but it's another to take that mismatched terminus and extend it and therefore immortalize it. And some of the things that are easier to make happen are harder to extend, and vice versa. So it's not as easy as it might sound. It's not just, well, let's just dose in different mutagens and get whatever what we want, you know. But we realize that's necessary in the field. And I agree. Insertion and deletion control, you know, at whim would be wonderful, you know. But for us right now, it's more important to have control over mutation frequency in a more dialable manner, because I think if one is going to get at the question you asked, population size versus number of generations, and then the question you asked about recurrence, it really is, and then as a function of mutation frequency, right? So what is the optimal mutation frequency? What if you exceed the error threshold, the eigen-error threshold? Can you, as McCaskill talked about, sort of stochastically dance over the error threshold and come back? We haven't been able to test that because we haven't had the knobs to tune yet. So, you know, that's something we in the field need.
One question is, why not to modify your
Well, I'll tell you. Well, maybe. Yeah, I'll tell you a thing we did unpublished because it didn't work very well was we took the continuously evolving system, right, and we said, here's what you've always needed: peptides. Right. So we tried just some individual amino acids, things like arginine, histidine, as well as simple peptides, including some peptides that were sort of interestingly chosen. We took peptides that come from NTP binding site of various biological proteins, all right, that are known to be involved in things like DNA repair and, you know, and polymerase active site, and carried out continuous evolution in the presence of such usually arginine-rich, glutamate-rich peptides, and chose them because they were soluble and that kind of thing. And so Have at it. If you want to use the peptide, do it. So after much continuous evolution, free. Oh, it's part of the media. It's in every tube. Yes. At, you know, like 100 micromolar concentration. That, no one can do that yet. If you could do continuous evolution of proteins, wow. Yeah, yeah. No, it was just, I think, just like the spirit of your question, which is, what if there's a potential cofactor for catalysis or for folding or both that's available? Would the molecules make use out of it? You know, having not that ability within themselves to, you know, that are, is provided by a short peptide. So we have the best case. After lots of continuous evolution, we got something that was threefold better exponential growth rate, logistic growth, in the presence of the peptide compared to the absence. Never published it, you know. So maybe we just haven't found the right peptide. Maybe we haven't gone longitudinal enough. Maybe it just doesn't need it at this point, you know. So maybe what we should have done was really crippled the system a lot more so that it was more needy for that peptide. I don't know. There, you know, and you can think of lots of kind of questions like that. I mean, one specifically that we're thinking about now is, I mentioned how the class 1 ligase and the DSL ligase both take advantage of the upstream sequence on the substrate, upstream from the promoter sequence. And you know, what we just intended as a tag and cloning sequence, they make tertiary contacts to that and use that either to help fold or bring about catalysis in a better sense. And if you remove that tag, they drop in efficiency. Or if you give them the non-cognate tag from the other polymerase, the other ribozyme, they do worse. And then we made this sort of universal substrate that's sort of tagless for the fair fight. What if we said the upstream tag is no longer a sequence of DNA that we use for cloning? It's now a peptide. Right? So we could put a peptide. Years ago, we developed a technology for ligating peptides and DNA together. Okay, so we could take our DNA, our RNA-DNA substrate, the DNA end, and ligate a peptide to its end and say, okay, now your substrate has a peptide hanging off of it. And now it's still not evolving, but now it's not just floating around in the soup. It's now on the substrate at a place where we know tertiary contacts have developed in the past. And would it then use that peptide to promote catalysis? I think that might be a way to force the question you're getting at, rather than just sort of throw it in the soup, which hasn't done much for it. No. So, you know, do you define the genotype after each round? So, you know, I mean, and I only showed you a little bit of genotypic analysis. Of course, we can do as much genotypic analysis as we have the energy to do. So there's two levels at which we could define the genotype. We could ask, what's the consensus sequence? And that's very easy, right? So we take the whole population, and that same primer for reverse transcriptase can now lead to dideoxy sequencing of the population, and we'd read the consensus sequence. We've done that sometimes. It gets a little tricky, and I didn't go through the story, but insertion and deletions do happen. They don't happen in a controlled manner, but they do happen. And so in the development of the DSL ligase to the point of continuous evolution, and as it entered the zigzags, you saw it was pretty ragged at the beginning, got better, then it kind of didn't do much better for a while, then it got much better. What actually happened was two different size molecules appeared, and we could see them on gels, you know, different size, and they had a different consensus sequence. And they were off-frame from each other. So if we did the grand consensus of the population, we would have got a double read and a lot of minor reads. It would have been a mess. So we had to track that the second way, which is clonally. So then you isolate from the population, clones, you determine their sequence, and that's how we recognize there are actually two major subpopulations competing. And then one of the subpopulations actually developed two subtypes, one that had a large insertion and one that didn't. And then one of those ended up winning, at least at the point to which I showed. Do I think there's a
constraint?
Well, I think there's lots of possible pathways, right? So, and if we do more recurrent studies, maybe we'll begin to see. I'm not sure we can ever map out all possible evolutionary trajectories, you know. But there's going to be some favorite ones, and what we certainly see is there's many ways to skin a cat. You know, there are lots of ways to solve the problem, and you know, a lot of it has to do with, of course, at the present time, what is the dominant individual and how good do you have to be to supplant it? And, of course, the dominant individual and its quasi-species distribution are the basis for the new variants, you know. So what happens when you come in with something that's more orthogonal to that? We may see some of that when we put the two species together, because with recombination, some more radical steps away can happen. You know, right now there's, you know, I don't think there's a general rule. I was going to say, you know, there's sort of the bulk of the population, but then it'll split and so on. You know, there's just so many possible sequence trajectories that are serviceable. I mean, you can look at the molecule and you could design variants that are going to work. You know, you could swap base pairs, change the stem, and so evolution can do that too. There's lots of ways to change it. What I would like to do is, again, this is a technology question, is it would be very nice on chip. So Brian Pagel, his PhD thesis was a microfluidic DNA sequencer. And he's convinced that it's not that hard to mate a microfluidic sequencer with the microfluidic evolution, and that you could, you know, leave the microfluidic evolution and go into, you know, sort of a poissonal, you know, like polony type, like George Church does, amplification of an individual, and then sequence it. And you could get sequence information as you go. But, you know, that's not something we're going to spend money on right now. But a microfluidic sequencer has been achieved and could be made into a microfluidic evolution machine. So, all right, are we winding down? All right, thanks, everybody.